Today, Senate Republicans unveiled a fresh health care proposal. This hour, we'll talk with an insider about his work in Washington on health care policy. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, I'll talk with University of Iowa public health researcher Brian Caskey about his current work in Washington to aid the U.S. Senate Special Committee on Aging. Then, last-minute state budget cuts affecting the Iowa Department of Public Health. We'll hear from directors of a few of the affected organizations about how the deep cuts will impact their services. That's all coming up. First, this hour's news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this half hour is Brian Caskey. As a University of Iowa public health researcher, Brian watched changes in national health care policy from afar during the Obama and George W. Bush administrations, but now he's right in the thick of it, working in our nation's capital. He's a University of Iowa associate professor in the Department of Health Management and Policy, working now in D.C. as part of the American Political Science Association's Congressional Fellow Program. He's assigned to the majority staff of the U.S. Senate Special Committee on Aging. That's a committee chaired by Senator Susan Collins, a Republican from Maine. His work for the committee draws on his expertise in Medicare, Medicaid, and caring for the elderly. We've had him on this program to talk about those topics before. Brian Caskey joining us today from Washington. Thank you for making time for us, Brian.
Well, thank you for having me.
I wanted to mention you've been in this position in Washington since November, right?
Correct. I moved out here actually right before the election and went through about a month's worth of training and then placed with the Senate Committee on Aging at the start of the year.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to get, of course, today a big auspicious health care day with the Republican proposal just coming out. I don't know how tuned in you are to that. In the last few minutes, it was unveiled in the last couple of hours there in Washington. But before I ask you what your reaction to that is and the extent you know about the proposal, give us a basic overview of what you're doing to aid this U.S. Senate Special Committee on Aging. What types of things are you doing?
Well, my job is really to examine age-specific issues for the professional staff here on the committee and assist their efforts, considering things like elder caregiving and how those issues that are specific to older adults intersect with the larger issues that we're seeing happening either in the healthcare space or the tax reform space or otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
So just this morning, for example, I attended a Hill event that focused on a bill that's being introduced that would provide a tax credit for employed caregivers. That is, people who are working jobs but also need to take time off to go home and take care of their mother or their father. And a shout out for all of you in Iowa. This is a bill that Senator Ernst's office is working on. So my job is to connect with those folks and see what their perspective on the issue is, and then I bring that back to my office, and we try to put things together and collaborate, and that's how you get bills moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Collaborate meaning finding areas of common ground and disagreement and ways to bridge disagreement?
Exactly, and what's actually really nice about working with the Special Committee on Aging is we have a pretty long and strong record of doing such collaborative work. So, for example, back to Senator Ernst's bill, that actually was submitted in collaboration with Democrat Senator Tammy Baldwin from Wisconsin. And the reason why we're interested in it, because Senator Collins and Senator Baldwin also worked on another caregiving bill earlier this spring. So the idea is, as these individual offices come up with their initiatives, you want to kind of coordinate. You know, you've heard the expression, there are, 535 individual policymaking bodies out here. Well, that's true. and we don't always know what each other's doing. And so this is a good example of how my job is to go out there and kind of make surveillance of what's going on and then reconcile that with other activities that are going on.
Brian, I wanted to focus in a few minutes more on your work, what you've experienced there, some more specifics on that. But first of all, your reaction to today's news, the Republicans unveiling a fresh proposal to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. I don't know the extent to which your work has you tied up and away from the news, if you've had a chance to look at this new proposal.
I haven't seen it yet, and I'm sort of reluctant to comment on what other people have said about it.
According to one of the news reports, like earlier versions, this would convert Medicaid from an open-ended entitlement to a system of fixed payments to states.
Right.
So the implications of that, perhaps you could explain?
Right. So in my role, what I'm asked to do is take an aging-specific issue, let's say like caregiving or preventive health services or issues surrounding post-acute care. When people are discharged from the hospital, what can we do to support them when they go back home? And then I take that construct, if you will, or that desired outcome of providing good care after people are discharged from the hospital, and then we read these bills and find out if there's anything that either A, directly addresses that topic, or B, if it isn't directly addressed, as many of the aging issues are not, you then have to draw inferences between how the changes in financing may impact. So in the case of something like Medicaid, changes to the Medicaid financing system, there's usually nothing ever that specific that say we're going to do this with older adults care. You have to, if you will, follow the trail and say that, well, if we do cut back on this particular program, it's likely to do this to, in our case, the aging service structure. And, you know, there's more than just the health care bill that we need to keep an eye on. There's several other, there's tax reform, there's budgets, and my job is basically to look at all of these things and then provide a perspective on how they may shape the provision of services to older persons.
Because they're all interlinked.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There's a lot going on.
So what are the specific aspects in the changes, the transition that we're going through, have you been dug into most?
Well, again, back to aging issues, caregiving, long-term care. We had a number of initiatives under the Affordable Care Act that actually looked to shore up what we call prevention efforts and health promotion efforts. So what are we doing to, for example, help older adults avoid a heart attack? Under the existing program, there were some initiatives out there that said we should probably increase our efforts to screen persons and identify those who are at risk of having heart failure before it happens. So that's a very specific activity that we saw moving forward. So now the question is, will these changes in the financing of healthcare, which is in large part what a lot of what's going on right now, how will those changes in financing affect that particular type of program?
Mm-hmm. Let me get you to react to one of the aspects here. I'm reading from the CNN website about this new Senate Republican plan. This revision includes, it says, a version of Texas Senator Ted Cruz's amendment, which would allow insurers offering Obamacare plans to also offer cheaper, bare-bones policies. Of course, to appeal to the conservatives there, but also moderates like Susan Collins, you work with, concerned about that. So this is something that we would see in these health care exchanges that would be different. Bare bones, you pay less, but do you get anything or do you get much?
Right, and that's been out there before. I mean, these were, you know, this is sort of what we had in place before, and in some respects, a lot of people did very well with these types of options. Remember, 9 out of 10 people that you survey at any given time, at least 9 out of 10 or maybe 8 out of 10, are actually very satisfied with the healthcare system in the United States and in Iowa. And in some respect, it's largely a function of we have very little intersection with our healthcare system at any given point. So I'm just thinking back on myself. I have not seen a doctor this year. I've had a need for an inpatient episode or an emergency room visit. But I know it's there, and I know the University of Iowa system is going to take care of me if and when it happens. So for me, as a person, it's hard to say that I don't like the healthcare system or I would really have a need for a different type of insurance plan. The issue here is for those one or two people who do have a consistent use of the healthcare system, and they do need some insurance to cover what we call chronic disabling conditions or what we call catastrophic conditions that may put them at risk. And when that happens, that's when you need a stronger insurance product to help cover all those expenses. And, you know, that's the great drama of insurance is can we predict when that happens to any person and can you switch over in time to make that choice? That's the hard part.
Mm-hmm. If you've just joined us, Brian Caskey is with me, University of Iowa professor of public health. He's spending the year as a congressional fellow assigned to the U.S. Senate Special Committee on Aging, which is chaired by Senator Susan Collins, of a Republican from Maine. Brian joining us, taking time from his working day in Washington, D.C. The few more minutes we have here, I wanted to get back to your work. But before that, I wonder, you know, we discuss health care policy a lot. You've been part of our discussions here on Iowa Public Radio in the past. Now that you're seeing policy made from the inside perspective, how does that compare with what we get reported in the press, what we report, what other press reports? Is it accurate, or your eyes been opened in a way that that most consuming the press, even the minutia in the press, cannot see?
Mm-hmm. Well, I got to admit, one thing that's impressed me is there are just so many stories that get told here in the Capitol on any given day. There are briefings, there are hearings, bills get introduced. Just yesterday, for an example, we had a hearing that focused on the changing nutritional status of our aging population. And I thought it was a very compelling story to highlight how the trend of obesity is now intersecting more with the trend of an aging population, so that we have a much larger number of older adults entering older age overweight. And you know, obesity compounds problems like heart disease, leads to more diabetes. And we not only reviewed the latest research in that area, but we also had witnesses present some effective solutions to this, you know, ways we could get healthcare systems to think more about evaluating the nutritional status of older adults, ways to get older adults to start thinking about eating more fruits and vegetables and healthier diets.
Mm-hmm.
I myself thought that was a great story, but there were also other hearings yesterday. I mean, we had a nomination review for an FBI director, and what story actually gets picked up by the media? Well, you know, that's beyond me. I think the media has their criteria for the stories they want to pick from. But no doubt there are a number of stories on any given day they could select.
Mm-hmm. Well, consuming the media on healthcare or any other topic, you get the impression that what goes on in Washington is partisan and becoming ever more so in recent years. What you tell me, it seems like it's evidence-based what people are doing in terms of improving policies. Their decisions, the thinking, the discussion based on science and data rather than on political leanings.
Well, that's, I think, also a reflection of where I am. The Senate Special Committee on Aging has a tremendous historical record of being a venue in which issues that basically affect everyone. I mean, aging is a universal condition, and we have a record in the committee of working with both sides to not only identify challenges and opportunities older adults face, but then coming up with potential solutions. I mean, the Committee on Aging is recognized by many as the birthplace of Medicare, for example. In our work in a committee, that's our job, is to get together with all people who are members of our committee and try to figure out how to make the best step forward. That's different than, for example, if I worked in a member's office. So if I worked for a particular senator, I may be assigned to do other things that, you know, depending on the senator's preferences, may be considered to be more partisan. But in our committee, it's actually one of our, if you will, feathers in our cap that we try to work together, and I think we've been doing that.
Mm-hmm. A few more minutes with you, Brian. Brian Caskey with us, if you just joined us, from the University of Iowa, spending a year as a congressional fellow to the U.S. Senate Special Committee on Aging in Washington. He joins us from Washington. Kelly is joining us from Davenport. Not much time, Kelly. What do you want to chip in for Brian?
Well, macro legislation is a huge bill that is affecting our health care providers and how payments are made. And it's pushing doctors to focus on the quality of care measures.
Mm-hmm.
But I've noticed the documentation and reporting to Medicare is very burdensome to practices, especially independent ones. And so I'm wondering how you in Washington are addressing that disconnect between the intention for payment by good outcomes versus the reporting burdens.
Hmm. Thanks, Kelly. Brian, can you tackle that?
Well, there is a long list, if you will, of points, or it's a long pathway in what we call policy development and implementation. So where Congress worked was to actually develop the notion of MACRA and get behind it, thinking that this would be a direction that the healthcare system should go. And they also authorized funding for it. And then, to be honest, that's kind of where the role of Congress stops. And then it gets handed off to the executive branch, in this case to Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. So they're charged now with taking sort of what we call legislative intent and then coming up with the actual day-to-day operations of how do you make a quality incentive payment program work for medical practices. So there's some amount of back and forth that needs to occur between the executive agencies and the different interests out there that are being impacted by MACRA. Now, down the road, I could see if MACRA is not meeting its objectives, or even if it's meeting the objectives and doing very well, then Congress would be asked to revisit, whether to keep shoring it up and supporting it or perhaps to adjust it. But that will be one of many issues that are right now, I think, on the back burner, because the primary focus right now is on this effort to repeal and replace.
Mm-hmm. Kelly, thanks for your question from Davenport.
Thank you.
All right. Before we say goodbye to you, Brian, in Washington, a couple of other questions. What has been the transition from you've worked for a long time in academia, now in Washington, in the political arena? What have been the major surprises?
Well, I have to put out there just how pleased I am and surprised by the staff who work with Senator Collins. This has really been a pleasure to work with these folks. Senator Collins has quite an impressive history of working in policy. One of the recent stories I've heard is how when she was a teenager, she came down here to the Senate for the summer and got to work with Margaret Chase Smith, who all you policy wonkers may recall is the first woman to be elected to both the Senate and the House. And you get a sense of quite a trajectory of the people who've been working with her and the issues that they've been working on for so long. That's just been a pleasure to be a part of. And, you know, the other part of this is it is a fast-paced environment. I mean, it is a, we need this. For example, yesterday I had someone come in and ask me to take a look at an issue and type up a response. I believe that request was dropped on me at 5:15, and they needed a response by 5:30. And I got to admit, I that sort of hurry up response is not what I'm used to. I usually say, well, I need to go do research on it and background, and they're trusting me to tap into my fund of knowledge. I mean, after all, I've been studying this stuff for more than 25 years, and give them a good, reasonable response within a short period of time. That's not typical of what an academic does.
Right. Well, it sounds like you're on a journalist's time schedule, timeline.
Well, there you go.
I understand you also work with hearings. You've helped out with hearings on a variety of issues, Alzheimer's, military caregiving, the opioid crisis. So you actually help to line up, what, expert witnesses in front of lawmakers?
Yeah, and to extend on your journalist analogy, this is a lot like producing a good, compelling one-hour episode. You want to find an issue that has an appeal or an interest to a wide body, not so specific that nobody is interested in. Then when you do find such a topic, you want to bring in novel perspectives and sort of the cutting edge. And so what we often do is line up a researcher who's sort of on the front end of an issue. So take the hearing we had yesterday on nutrition and aging. We brought in two faculty who were experts in the latest trends. And then we have them tell their stories, and then we have other witnesses come in and say how they've developed programs or responses to this challenge so they can give us a direction or a sense of where to move forward. And one of the nice things, too, about convening these hearings is we try to make a deliberate effort to reach into the states in which our committee members represent. So that lets people in the state Senator Collins represent, Maine, that she's engaged in issues that matter to them. So she brings down witnesses from that state, and that's a way to get the members of the committee engaged as well. It's been told to me that we have some of the better turnouts because the members on our committee are really concerned with these issues, and we bring in witnesses from their states, and that engages them.
Mm-hmm.
And we find it to be very productive.
Mm-hmm. Back to my a different way of asking an earlier question. So it sounds to me like, we have on these the expert witnesses in committee meetings that the arguments are winning the day, the best arguments rather than the strongest politics.
Well, again, we're in a unique position with the Special Committee on Aging because of our history and because of the issues we pick are just, they're universal. Caregiving is not a partisan issue for us. Everybody has to, at least most everybody, as we've seen from the data, is involved with taking the care of their parents at one point or another. So we look to first define the commonalities around that, and we look to find solutions that are amenable, what can be done. And that's where our committee stops. We are not authorized to introduce actual legislation or make authorizations. So in our part of the process, we then take that information and then we hand it off. And that's what I meant about a pathway or a sequence of decision making. The next committee or another member will grab that, and then they'll say, okay, let's write a bill. And then that's where the, if you want to say, partisanship may come in.
Right.
Where one member says, I think we should do it this way.
Right. So you're early on in the sausage making production, if we could put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Brian, we've run out of time. It's been a joy to talk with you, giving us some insights from now as an insider there, working since November in Washington, D.C., as a congressional fellow assigned to the U.S. Senate Special Committee on Aging, chaired by Senator Susan Collins of Maine. University of Iowa Professor of Public Health, Brian Caskey. I hope to talk to you again in the future, Brian. Thanks so much.
Look forward to hearing from you. Thank you.
Brian Caskey joining us live from Washington. Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk about these last-minute state budget cuts, how they've affected the Iowa Department of Public Health. We'll hear from Joyce Russell, also from directors of a few of the affected organizations about how the deep cuts will impact their services. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Back with more River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. Last month, the state announced last-minute budget cuts, some of which affect the Iowa Department of Public Health. Those cuts took effect on July 1st. Several agencies have lost a substantial amount of funding that they drew from the Department of Public Health. Some lost more than half of their funding. 10 public health programs saw their funding through the state's Department of Public Health completely eliminated. Now, many of those programs receive some funding from other sources in addition to the state. That's something to keep in mind. In just a moment, we'll hear from the directors of a few of the affected organizations about what happens for them next after these surprise budget cuts. First, though, let's talk with IPR State House correspondent Joyce Russell about why the state was forced to slash the budget here. Joyce Russell, hi.
Hello, Ben.
So there was a last-minute round of budget cuts that took effect, were announced in June, that took effect just July 1st. Give us some background on that.
Well, I really consider these cuts at the Department of Public Health, cuts announced at the Department of Natural Resources very recently, as kind of the other shoe dropping. Just to give you a quick history, Iowa revenues have been falling short of projections starting in December, and then again in March. And so after the December estimate came down, the first thing the legislature had to do was come in January and cut millions of dollars from the budget for the fiscal year that we were still in, the one that ended June 30th. Mm-hmm. So the agencies were having to, absorb those cuts with just a few months left in the fiscal year. Then March comes around, the Revenue Estimating Conference again reduces estimates, not just for 2017, but for 2018 as well. So what that meant was Governor Branstad had submitted his 2018 budget in January. Not only did they have a problem balancing the 2017 budget, but then the governor had to resubmit a budget for 2018. And so it was sort of cuts upon cuts. The 2017 budget was slashed. And then those dollars weren't put back before then. There were more cuts for the 2018 budget. And mm-hmm. So what you saw was when the legislature was, struggling with this budget, they spelled out a lot of things, and we heard controversy about those, like the Leopold Center, big high profile domestic violence. We heard about that. That was actually spelled out in the budget, but then, tens of millions of dollars were really left up to the agencies to handle. It was almost like the legislature said, having as much of a stomach as they had for making these cuts. And then at a certain point, they said, you have to make do. And that's why we're seeing now that they're starting the fiscal year, we're seeing the agency saying, OK, well, this is what we're going to have to do.
OK. Very quickly before we go, Joyce, so I'm wanting to get a picture of a hazy crystal ball, or as far as the state revenues and the budget shortfalls, or is there sort of blame to be put somewhere?
Well, a lot of people are complaining about the estimates being off, but they are just estimates. And I think over the last several years, the budget surpluses have been reduced because of some long-term big spending commitments, including property tax reductions and the biggest property tax cut in the state's history, and also a long-range teacher quality plan. So that reduced, year by year, reduced that surplus, so that the surpluses have been much smaller. And then you add to that, revenues not quite making it. When they submitted the budget for 2018, that the legislature approved, it's just almost nothing left, at the, mm-hmm. no wiggle room at all. And so it's just been a cumulative effect.
Okay. Joyce Russell, Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent. Thanks for the background on these last minute budget cuts.
Okay. Thank you, Ben.
Take care, Joyce. Let's look at how the rubber meets the road, I guess we say, in terms of these budget cuts, talking with a few of the directors in the next few minutes of the affected organizations. Again, these last-minute budget cuts, not only to the Department of Public Health, but that's what we're addressing here, cuts that took effect July 1st. Gene Burmeister is with us, Executive Director of Prevent Blindness Iowa. Hi, Gene.
Hi, Ben.
So you lost how much of your money through the Department of Public Health?
We lost about 40% of our budget.
40%? Wow. Mm-hmm. That's a big cut. And mm-hmm. how much of your budget money comes from the Department of Public Health?
about 40%.
Oh, okay. So you do what at the Prevent Blindness Iowa?
Well, our mission is to preserve sight and prevent blindness, and we have been in business for nearly 60 years, and we started with a children's vision screening program because we are not aware that children do not know how they should be seeing, and so they don't complain even if they're seeing double or blurry and not as crisp as they should be. So parents and adults in their life are not aware that they have a vision problem. So we're part of a national organization that takes best practices. We had done a survey about 10 years ago with school nurses on do you feel good about your vision screening or would you attend a training program, and 97% of the responses were we need to be trained.
Mm-hmm.
So we go throughout the state and train nurses, and we're trying to standardize how they conduct vision screening, what the referral criteria is, make sure they have the proper charts. So we provide the charts and all the materials they need to perform vision screening at the school district.
And this significant budget cut to Prevent Blindness Iowa was a surprise to you completely?
It was a complete surprise. We did, from the December estimate, the Department of Health cut everybody's appropriation by 3.8%, I believe. We were not prepared on the second one because the budget had been passed and the governor had signed it, that it would come through, especially only 2 weeks' notice before our new fiscal year.
Mm-hmm. How big is your budget?
Our budget's about $225,000, $250,000.
Okay, $250,000. You train nurses, other educators to give vision screenings to kids. How will these cuts affect you? I know it's probably still being discussed within your organization. How are you going to deal with this, right?
Exactly. We're going to work even smarter than we do right now. We are a good steward of resources, so we are trying to develop the new program and what it's going to look like.
Mm-hmm. What are your options?
Webinars, fee-for-service, reducing the number of trainings we go out and provide. And in that money, too, we also provide hands-on ourselves vision screening to preschool through high school. So it's going to impact not just training of nurses, and we train public health and lay volunteers also.
Give us an idea, Jean, of how many people will be impacted or are touched by Prevent Blindness Iowa?
Just through the vision screening program, we estimate with the volunteers we have throughout the state that they're screening about 45,000 or more children.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier, quickly before we have to move on to another guest here, that it's not always apparent to kids that they have a vision problem. For someone who doesn't understand that, can you give an example?
Sure. So in a preschool child where one eye is not working, it's called amblyopia or lazy eye blindness. And that child is looking through one eye that's getting weaker and weaker and weaker. And if that problem is not detected and corrected early in life, they will live with that throughout their life. And that costs the rest of us about over $4 million a year. Going forward. A child that needs glasses, we did a lot of screening here in the metro area, that we were screening first graders through fifth graders. We referred an average of 26% of the kids that needed to be put in glasses or were wearing the wrong prescription. So we look at screening as an education piece to the parents, don't forget about their eyes, as well as education piece on everybody should have a routine eye exam. A screening is a screening. We're not doctors.
Mm-hmm. Is your hope, Jean, that this will be a one-time dip in the budget there? Will this be restored? Anything you've heard about that?
We haven't heard. We're hopeful, but judging by the revenue estimates, they haven't been favorable in the past 6 to 9 months. So.
Okay.
Keep our fingers crossed.
All right, certainly. Jean Burmeister, Executive Director of Prevent Blindness Iowa, thanks for telling us a little bit about what you do and how you're dealing with these significant budget cuts.
Thank you very much.
Talking this half hour about the last-minute budget cuts to the Department of Public Health, hearing from a few of the directors of the affected organizations about the impact and what happens next. Roxanne Kogel is with us, Director of Iowa Epilepsy Services. Hi, Roxanne.
Hi, Ben.
So tell us about your cut.
So we were prepared for the first round of cuts of 3.8% during the the middle of fiscal year 17, but we were not prepared for the second round of cuts, which was recently announced 2 weeks prior to July 1st. And that is because our Epilepsy Services for Iowans program is a specific line item in the Health and Human Services budget. While many other programs were eliminated or reduced in funding, our program remained intact in that budget, and that bill was signed by the governor. And so when we were notified by the Iowa Department of Public Health that our program was completely eliminated, we were very surprised.
Wow. So you thought you were safe and then completely eliminated. How much money eliminated?
It was our entire program, which is nearly 60% of our budget. Our entire program allotment that was allocated to us through the Iowa Department of Public Health, which they have been providing us for over 10 years to have staff in Iowa. We provide training programs on seizure recognition and first aid, and many of our curriculum programs are in conjunction with the Center for Disease Control. So they're accredited programs. We have programs for first responders, law enforcement, medical professionals, school nurses, school staff, senior caregivers, agency staff, as well as for community, civic, and agency organizations. Because many times when somebody witnesses a convulsive seizure, for example, they call 911 every single time, which results in unnecessary emergency room visits, and it costs the state millions of dollars. And that is one of the main reasons why the state funded us, because we saved the state a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And we exceeded our outcomes measures in fiscal year 17 by 560%. I think we were required to do 15 programs, and we conducted nearly 90 education programs across the state. We're an extremely efficient organization.
So, taking by what you said about your work in the seizure with your seizure recognition program, when your budget is cut, are you predicting then that there'll be waste elsewhere in the state because of your budget cut?
Well, it certainly could be more costly. The CDC tells us that approximately a third of individuals with epilepsy rely on Medicaid for access to their physicians and medicines and for their health care costs. So when people aren't provided the training on how to properly recognize and respond to seizures, people generally call 911 every single time. And it's because it's the fear of seeing that seizure. Now, approximately 28,000 people live with epilepsy in the state of Iowa, and one out of every 26 people will develop epilepsy at some point in their lifetime. It could be any one of us, and 70% of the time, the cause is unknown, and there's no one-size-fits-all treatment for epilepsy.
Mm-hmm. So how are you going to deal with these cuts?
Well, we are still going to be able to provide programs and services. We're going to have to change on how we deliver those programs. For example, we're going to be doing more webinars to increase our efficiencies, to cut down that travel time and the time traveling across the state. We will still be able to do some in-person trainings for those very large groups. And we do have some reserve funding to tap into. But we've done everything we possibly can. The governor is upholding the department's decision. And so now we are working on developing new partnerships, and privately we'll be doing more raising funds to help continue providing services across the state.
Mm-hmm. And I understand this, before we go, this is affects you personally. You have a family member with a seizure disorder.
I do have a daughter with epilepsy who's been through a couple brain surgeries, and that's what led me to switch careers a few years ago.
Okay. Roxanne Kogel, thank you very much, Director of Iowa Epilepsy Services, talking about the cuts to that agency, that organization. Thank you very much, Roxanne.
Yeah, thank you, Ben, and also would like to share with people that if they want to keep our programs going and to donate, to go to our website at epilepsyiowa.org.
Thanks, Roxanne.
Thank you very much.
And finally, in this half hour, as we are looking at some of the organizations directly affected by the budget cuts, last-minute budget cuts announced just last month in June to the Department of Public Health. Let's talk with the Associate Director of the Autism Society of Iowa, Aaron Enyart. Aaron, are you there?
I am. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you. We don't have much time, about 5 minutes here. So tell us, I understand that the Regional Autism Assistance Program, one of 10 programs that recently lost all of its state funding, is that the extent of your huge budget cut, huh?
Yeah. The Regional Autism Assistance Program lost about 70% of their budget with these recent cuts. So obviously that's going to take a huge chunk of, you know, what they can provide for Iowa families.
Mm-hmm. So what do you do at the Autism Society of Iowa?
The Autism Society of Iowa provides statewide advocacy and support for families and individuals affected by autism. So we have various board members throughout the state and offer trainings and conferences and things like that for all Iowa families.
Mm-hmm. Do you have plans or are you in discussion about how these budget cuts will be dealt with?
Well, the RAP program, obviously losing 70% of the budget, is going to have to make some changes. And the main issue right now is the loss of the family navigators. They're kind of located throughout the whole state, and families can reach out to them when they receive that first initial diagnosis and get information on resources and services and how to deal with the education system and, what their insurance might cover and, you know, what the best doctors in their area are. And so families are really concerned about how they're going to get those, get that help that they need when they get that initial diagnosis.
So a family navigator is a person, is a position. That's a job that will be cut around the state.
It is. They're throughout the state. I believe there's probably about 20 of them throughout the state, and it really helps those families that live in rural areas that don't have, you know, the access to services like we might have in the metro. They can reach out to this person and, you know, get the names of places. With that initial diagnosis, there's just so much information, and it's easier to have that person kind of help wade through that with you.
Mm-hmm. Do you have an idea of the number of jobs that will be cut due to this budget cut?
I don't know, but like I said, I believe, you know, 15 to 20 navigators, I believe, is about how many there are throughout the state. So, if all of those positions are cut, that's going to make, you know, a huge difference for the services that Iowa families are going to have.
Some of the other directors we talked with that mentioned that perhaps coping with these cuts through, I guess, new technology, webinars, mm-hmm. and so forth. Is this some an avenue that you're exploring as well?
Well, you know, I think that's a way, definitely a way that we can do it. You know, we offer a lot of information on our website, as well as University of Iowa, you know, has a lot of information. It's just nice to have that person who's been through it. All the navigators are either caregivers or family members of people with autism, so they've kind of been there, and it's nice to have that one-on-one contact with the person, and I just think families are really going to miss that.
Right. And this is also something that affects you personally and your family as well, if you don't mind sharing that.
Yeah, it is. I have a daughter and a son, 12 and 11, that both have autism. So I've kind of been through, that initial diagnosis and the barrage of information. And it's just, you know, back when my kids were diagnosed, we didn't have, you know, all the resources we have now. And I just think having that family navigator is crucial for those families, so they can move forward in getting, you know, the services that their loved one needs.
Mm-hmm. What has access to services from RAP, the Regional Autism Assistance Program, meant to your family?
Well, I just think that it's that initial contact. Like I said, you know, I would have had to do, you know, doing a Google search is not, you know, it's not as personal as talking to someone who's been through it themselves. And I just think that that's what families really need. And I know that's what my family needs, being able to sit down with someone and, you know, share an experience and have them say, you know, yes, we've been through that. And here's somebody you can reach out to for help. I just think that, you know, that helps take that burden off a family, you know, who, like I said, has so much information to go through.
Right, right. And again, in rural areas where you might not have connections with a lot of other people in your position who have autism in the family, right?
Exactly. And if you don't have a large hospital in your area, or, you know, you're not familiar with your AEA, you know, this might be the person that can put you in contact with, you know, those services so that, you know, you can get started, because you really have to hit the ground running once you get that diagnosis. You've got to, you know, find the doctors and find the therapies that you need, and it's just so much information. So having that person to help you, especially in those rural areas, is really crucial.
Tell us, before we say goodbye, Erin, how our listeners find out more about the Autism Society of Iowa.
Yeah, definitely you can go to the Autism Society of Iowa webpage. There's also an Autism Society of America webpage that, you know, if you want to see some of the other services throughout the country, you know, we, like I said, we offer trainings and conferences and lots of events for families that they can, you know, hit throughout their area. We offer pool parties and lots of things for kids to do. So, yeah, I encourage people to check out the website.
Okay, thank you very much. Erin Enyart is Associate Director of the Autism Society of Iowa. Thank you very much, Erin.
Thank you so much for having me.
I've been talking this past half hour with some of the directors of organizations affected by some last-minute budget cuts announced in June. And as we heard, complete surprises to some of these people. Of course, many more organizations affected than we were able to talk with this half hour. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, with help from Robbie Broad. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. Tune in tomorrow, a News Buzz edition on Friday, waiting for you. That's tomorrow on River to River. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Hope to talk with you again tomorrow.